He had the fairly rare distinction to, while at Stanford, run across a course in nanotechnology taught by Eric Drexler, which is part of what inspired him to become so involved. And so he co-founded the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology as a way to oppose the Center for Irresponsible Nanotechnology, which was just getting way too much press.
You think you're joking, but you're not.
Well, there wasn't an organization actually called the Center for Irresponsible Nanotechnology. But so they have been developing a number of programs in line with many of the themes that Forsythe has also advocated for, making sure that nanotechnology is developed in a responsible manner. And he is here today to address us as well on some of the environmental issues of keeping things clean. I believe the subtitle of your talk is no... okay. He doesn't want me to say that.
Don't give away punchlines.
Don't give away punchlines. All right. So with no further ado, Chris Phoenix.
Thank you. The punchline is... Thank you. No, this is not well funded yet. Hopefully this conference will start to change that. Okay. Why do we want clean manufacturing? Well, today manufacturing uses all sorts of stuff from low down on the periodic table, which is hard to get out of the ground, and using it tends to use dirty chemistry, and then when you get rid of it, you put it back in the surface of the ground where it gets into the groundwater, and that's nasty. Processing with, you know, tens of thousands of different materials and processes, stuff leaks out the sides. Coating, you spray stuff on, where does the rest of the spray go? You make something, it has extra bits stuck on, you cut them off and throw them away, and they go in the ocean. Chemistry nowadays is pretty imprecise, because you put a whole bunch of stuff in a pot and you cook it. And what you're left with is sludge, which this picture is supposed to represent. And sludge is mixed up and hard to separate and really good for nothing except polluting groundwater again. If you can do chemistry mechanically, if you can take molecules that are strongly bound to other molecules and not leave any atoms floating around loose, I want to say a little bit about fingers and atoms. I want to say a little bit about fingers and atoms because the idea has somehow gotten started that mechanical chemistry is about fingers grabbing atoms, and the fingers, of course, have to be smaller than the atoms, and that's impossible, so it won't work. No. Mechanical chemistry is about molecules binding to other molecules strongly, like you saw in Eric's video yesterday. There's no fingers, there's no atoms. What there is, molecular fragments moved from one molecule to another. There's recyclable tools, at least once we get past the very early lab stages, and this has been proposed since at least 1997. Now, since the atoms are all strongly bound, that means you have to do something with every one of them. Everything you do with them is a product of one form or another. And the latest thinking on this is if you start with acetylene, as shown in Eric's video, what you do with the extra hydrogens is you build octane, which is what you use to deliver the acetylene. So in other words, the factory builds more useful stuff, and it builds no waste because it's taking in hydrogen and carbon, and it's putting out hydrogen and carbon in a very high-quality hydrocarbon. Okay, the chemical bonds that are expected to be used will survive for millennia, if not tens of billions of years at room temperature. Basically, the atoms are not going to fly around. The reactions are all precise, verifiable. If something goes wrong, you try it again. There's another rumor going around that this mechanical chemistry can't work at room temperature. Well, room temperature atom removal has been done. They've picked out a particular hydrogen and taken it off at room temperature. Little bit about what's already been done with mechanical chemistry. You can take a single silicon atom from a crystal, take it away, look at the spot where it was, and put it back. Also, mechanical force has been used to bond amino acids without a catalyst. I believe that was also done at room temperature. Molecular manufacturing is about precise chemistry. This is, you can see the green atom coming down and being fastened to the product. And there's no yield in the chemical sense where you have 95% yield and 5% sludge. The atom either transfers or it doesn't and you try again. So that gives you very clean manufacturing. One nice thing about this is because it's based on covalent chemistry, it uses light elements, stuff from the top rows of the periodic table. These, with a couple of exceptions, tend to be pretty innocuous. Easy to dispose of, easy to make into harmless organic or simple gases, you know, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, stuff that it's not too bad to dump as long as you don't dump too much of it. Light elements are all over the surface of the world. You don't have to mine for carbon. You don't have to mine for nitrogen. And you don't have to transport them from one continent to another. So that will save on energy and also, they're easy to recycle. You can burn it cleanly, filter the gases to make it even more clean, and it will be easier to dispose of your laptop than to, cleaner to dispose of your laptop by burning than to drive a car today. High-performance products means you need less material. Something like this with sub-nanometer feature sizes, you can take advantage of scaling laws. You can take advantage of very high covalent bond density for high strength. And basically, products could weigh somewhere between 1/100th and 1/1,000,000th or so what they do today. You're just manufacturing a lot less stuff. Motors in particular can shrink, and computers can shrink. So this could power your car with enough left over to make it fly. What is molecular manufacturing? Programmable chemistry, I've talked about that a little bit, but when you can control a robot to do a chemistry or design a conveyor belt to do a chemistry, then you can build pretty much anything you can design. That's not to say you can build anything in the world, but you can build any shape that you can put into the CAD program. You do a few operations in programmable locations, and build the features that you want. With molecular features, you can get computers, you know, a million times smaller than today's. You can get motors that are 50 nanometers wide, which makes them a million times more powerful than today's because of scaling laws. Engineered structures means instead of guessing at what you want or saying, you know, plus or minus 0.01%, you get exactly what you want. And this is also different from self-assembly. In self-assembly, you design something that you hope will fit together right. It's not quite engineering. There's an intermediate step of complexity that makes it hard to engineer. We saw yesterday how chemical construction can be used to make things easier to engineer. So you can go directly from the shape to the molecular design to the fabrication of that shape. That's going to make it easier to build lots of advanced products with this technology rather quickly. Reliable operation. Covalent chemistry is, in general, digital. Either the bond is there or it's not. That means you can automate it, and that means that you can scale up a lot of very small manufacturing systems in parallel. And that's how this, you know, two atoms at a time robotic chemistry can actually make large products. Autoproductive manufacture means basically a factory system can build something with the physical complexity of the factory. And the way you do this is you feed in the extra complexity from the software. So a system can build something physically more complex than itself if you plug a computer into it. Autoproductive manufacture and reliable operation mean that you get exponential manufacturing, meaning that if you have one factory, you can tell it to build another factory. Then you take that factory out, plug it in, and tell it to build another factory. So this is not a low-throughput technology. This is a very, very high-throughput technology. Okay, I've already talked about some of this. This is the slide with the physics and numbers. Several kilowatts per cubic millimeter of electrostatic motor generators. This takes a lot of work, a lot of constraints out of a lot of designs. Instead of having space under your hood for your car engine, you just stick it in the axle somewhere. Instead of having an engine hanging off your plane in a big thing with a motor mount that weighs 10% what the engine does, you stick the engine in the propeller shaft somewhere. So products can be a lot higher performance. As the size of the feature shrinks, you can put in a billion times as many features when you shrink them by 1,000. You can put in a quintillion times as many features if you shrink it by 1,000,000, and that's what we're talking about. Until recently, the fastest computer on Earth was the Earth Simulator, which occupied a large building, took, I think, several megawatts of power, and cost quite a lot of money. You could fit that into a grain of rice. And I didn't mention it here, but it would take 2 watts to run it. 2 watts, that's about 1% of this laptop. Strength, 100 times as strong as steel. But you get another factor of 10, another order of magnitude strength, more or less, because it's hard to build something to resist compression. You squish it, it tends to buckle. You have to make it really thick to resist that. But a steel cable of a certain strength is much thinner than an I-beam of that strength. And there are games you can play like fractal trusses and structural pressure tanks when you can build very small stuff that should give you at least another order of magnitude. Now, remember the 10-pound, well, no, that's in the next slide, sorry. For this slide, think about a 10-pound airplane, yacht, or car. A hang glider today weighs 60 pounds. If you can make materials 100 times as strong as that, then it makes real sense to talk about, you know, a Cessna or something that weighs 10 pounds. You get out, you fold it up, and you put it in your pocket and walk away. Then you get to the parking lot, pull out your car, unfold it, and drive away. If you're on the ocean, then you do the same thing for your yacht. Now, this sounds outrageous, but assuming we can figure out how to fold it up tightly enough, this is completely plausible because the motors are 1,000,000 times smaller. Your car engine is like this, and, you know, the rest of the car is like this or better, and it works. Scalability. There is a rumor that mechanical chemistry is really, really slow. Well, when things get smaller, they work faster. A millipede moves its legs very quickly, and an elephant moves its legs very slowly. So at nanometer scales, you know, 10, 100 nanometers, you get about 1,000,000 operations a second. And that's pretty conservative. Now, a 1/5 micron cube contains 1 billion atoms. That's enough, more than enough, to build a robot arm. And 1 billion atoms takes 1,000 seconds to build. That's less than an hour. Okay, since these systems are reliable, you can run lots of them in parallel. You can start with one robot arm, have it build 2, have those build 4, have those build 8, and I wrote a paper last year that analyzed in detail how in a month you could go from one submicron robot to a tabletop nanofactory that could produce, you know, 10 kilograms a day. So remember that 10-pound car? Well, that was made with a 10-pound factory in a day. And if you got impatient and decided you wanted to make 2 cars per day, you spend one day making a second factory, and now you have double your manufacturing base. So, getting back to the topic of the talk, there's lots of unclean things we do today. We burn fossil fuels. If you can build things 1,000 times lighter, you can build solar cells for, you know, a few grams per square meter, quite cheap. And suddenly you have all the solar energy you need. Dirty manufacturing. We have today lots and lots of money invested in dirty manufacturing infrastructure. but it will not take comparable effort to replace that manufacturing infrastructure. The effort it will take is about like that, telling the factory to build another factory. Do that as many times as you need. I've just destroyed the business case here for doing this, and I'll get into economic implications some more in my afternoon talk. As I said, you can rebuild infrastructure quickly because this scales so well, so quickly. If there's something that's less efficient than you would like, it'll be cheap to replace it. You won't have to spend 5 years building a new light bulb factory to make fluorescent tubes instead of incandescents. You can just download the program to your nanofactory and build all the light bulbs you want. That's the nice thing about general purpose manufacturing. Okay, agriculture takes a lot of water, destroys topsoil, creates runoff. Well, put it in greenhouses. One of the reasons we don't have greenhouses today is that they cost a lot of money to build. But if you can build inflatable diamond shells, 10-pound greenhouse, you know, very cheap. And there's also some research needed to figure out how to make the plants grow in the greenhouses, but when the greenhouses and the high-tech hydroponic equipment and the high-tech grow lights and the high-tech monitoring to make sure no pests get in, when all of that can be built very cheaply once you design it, then we're looking at an agricultural revolution. Speaking of greenhouses, greenhouse gases are a major concern today. Well, if we have too much CO2 in the atmosphere, and if we can build as much of a product as we need, we could build small solar-powered airplanes that fly through the atmosphere, scooping up carbon dioxide, and then dive into the ocean, swim down, and deposit it at a level where it'll stay, where it'll solidify and sink to the bottom, and then go back up and fly around some more and collect some more carbon dioxide. They fly around to make the process faster. This is a completely plausible product. It wouldn't be that hard to engineer, and it would take care of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, not just stopping the increase, but actively reducing them in a matter of years. Other problems, monitoring will become a lot cheaper. Scott Mize said we need a global nervous system. That creates some new problems that I'll talk about this afternoon, but one thing that it does let you do is it lets you look for problems. Today there's a lot of controversy about, are the amphibians disappearing and what does that mean? And it's possible for people to say, oh, they're not disappearing at all. This is a problem of data gathering. Same with global warming. Oh, we don't have enough sensors. They're all in cities, et cetera. Well, if you can put a sensor on every square mile, if you can put a camera on every pond unintrusively and cheaply, then it becomes possible to actually look and see what's going on. And if a problem starts, it's a lot easier and sooner to notice, and gives you a lot more time to correct it before it gets to be a big problem. Okay, in the end, we only have one planet that's green. But if we can go out to space for our raw materials, if we can go out to space when we get tired of the political structure here, if we can go out to space for things we haven't even thought of yet, then the small planet problem, to some extent, gets easier. Now, space travel today is not really sustainable. You couldn't put every person on Earth into space. It would just take too much energy. But fundamentally, it doesn't take much more than... It takes less energy than a person uses in a year to get them up to orbital speed or even escape velocity. And all we need is more efficient systems to do that. Things like airplanes with configurable wings and very small power plants. You send them up to 100,000 feet, and then you turn them into rockets. That's much more efficient. Now, a sneak preview of this afternoon's talk. With this amazingly scalable and efficient manufacturing, we have the opportunity to pave paradise and put up a parking lot everywhere on Earth in, about a month. We could at least cover, if not reshape, large areas of Earth, possibly with solar cells. heat pollution appears to be a fixed limit on Earth. There's only so much energy you can dump into the environment before it overheats, because there's really no good way to get heat off planet other than radiation, which is slow. So heat pollution credits will remain scarce even after this amazing technology comes into being. Weapons manufacture this programmable factory with very high capacity, making very advanced products. Well, you can make very advanced weapons in very high capacity. Intellectual property control, a major issue. Social and ethical issues, that's for this afternoon. Okay, conclusion. This technology of mechanical chemistry can be as, and probably will be, as precise and elegant as digital logic. And just for comparison, I calculated a few days ago that a modern desktop computer does a good fraction of a mole of transistor operations per week. Now, a mole is the number of atoms in a few grams of stuff. And in nanotech terms, it's a very large quantity. You know, people boast of being able to do millimoles. But if you look at the number of transistors in a CPU, the number of operations per second, and the number of seconds in a week, it's a good fraction of a mole that happens flawlessly. So the idea that it's impossible to do that many engineered things and have them work, well, we already do it today. There are lots of ways that we simplify it, and there will be lots of ways to simplify this technology. It's so high performance that we can afford to do it simply instead of elegantly. That's why engineering has been so successful for the last three centuries. Okay. I want to mention a new website that I started just less than a month ago, wisenano.org. It's a collaborative website. And so the point is that everyone here can go and not only read but write opinions, contributions, and CRN is not big enough, Foresight is not big enough to think through all of the issues. But all of you here, plus everyone else who hopefully will come now that I've built it, may be able to help think through the issues. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Chris. Michael Mehta again from Canada. Quick question about possible economic implications, which I know will be covered a little bit more in detail this afternoon. If we can move to a future state where molecular manufacturing becomes possible, do we then have a technology that actually operates as an anti-globalizing technology? We don't need to participate, for example, in foreign trade to the same extent that we do. We don't need to have the same kind of offshore manufacturing that we do. Is this a force, what I call my reading of nano-mercantilism?
Okay, good question. Physical trade looks like it'll decrease because you can get your resources and your manufacturing right at the point and time of use. Trade in intellectual property will probably increase because if you invent something in one place, it's presumably useful in many other places. So we'll probably see a lot more trade in ideas while we see less trade in physical stuff. Yeah, down here. Oh, I'm sorry, he was next.
John Young, I'm a consultant. If you'll pardon something of a pun, you've been opening new windows on the future for us. Do you foresee any possible problems in a future in which almost everything is a result of programming?
Yeah, the internet is a sneak preview of that. And I'll talk about that more this afternoon. But yes, if everything is programmable, then it's really easy to make systems that are brittle or vulnerable. Yeah, down here.
To do with the social implications. Yeah. Today's world and the discussion of jobs, if jobs are changing because machine tools might be going away and more education is required, And it could be very quickly, according to what I'm hearing. How are we addressing that as far as not letting fear rule the day?
Ah, okay, you're asking two questions. One is the economic question. The other is the social perception question. Economically, I would say we will probably still have work, but it may not be in the form of jobs. Jobs are a fairly recent invention. There will be some amount of retraining, some amount of service jobs, including customized design. I'm not an economist, but I'm pretty skeptical that we will have enough jobs as, you know, 9 to 5 with a boss with a salary. I'm pretty skeptical that we will have enough jobs for everyone. Hopefully what that means is there will be other ways of people having the resources they need to live without having to punch a time card to get them. I really should have an economist up here to answer the question. As far as public fear, hopefully the abundance, the possibility of abundance will outweigh the possibility of unemployment. Will we be retired or unemployed? I don't know, but we should start asking the question, and we should start looking for how to get a favorable answer.
More of a science question, which a couple of points you mentioned. One was heat dissipation, and another was the issue of shrinking power plants. I think at one point you mentioned the possibility of putting several kilowatts in a cubic millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some pretty fundamental laws of physics against having a perfectly efficient motor, at least once you want to put a load on it. So at what point does heat dissipation from such a small volume become an issue? Are these things going to run incandescent, or is there a way to extract the heat out, or has this not been thought about?
Okay, well, if you put a kilowatt in a cubic millimeter and it's 99% efficient, then you're only dissipating 10 watts, and diamond is a pretty good heat conductor. I think that's doable. As far as fundamental inefficiency, yes, you can't be perfectly efficient, but you can be pretty darn close. Basically, if you avoid high speeds and if you avoid irreversible state transitions, then you can be pretty much as efficient as you like, and the only thing you're trading off is power density. If you run 10 times as slowly, you will be more than 10 times as efficient. And there are designs for electrostatic motors with no irreversible state transitions. Nothing goes off a cliff. There's one down. Is there anyone on the other side? Okay.
Yeah, I'm Edgar from North Carolina State University.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about this nano-replication.
Mm-hmm.
You keep talking about making products that can be useful on a sort of macroscopic scale,
mm-hmm.
but you're piecing atom by atom.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you hope to be able to piece together? We're talking probably quadrillions of atoms,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and I know replication is a good thing, but to what extent can you really replicate? Like, for instance, you want to replicate a factory.
Okay.
Do we do that macroscopically already? And what kinds of factories do we really replicate that well?
Do you remember in Eric's animation, were you here yesterday to see that? Okay. So remember the last stage was he took small blocks and plugged them into a surface. And if you can build a block with a billion atoms, that leaves plenty of room for strong mechanical joints, possibly strong chemical joints. So mechanically it looks like there's not too much problem in hooking small blocks together to make big products, big structures. Performance-wise, that's fast enough if you have, you can hook together, okay, small submicron blocks directly to build a growing product at a rate of, you know, a centimeter per second or something. Functionally, I currently have a grant from NIAC, the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts, to look at how to do that. I've just started, but it looks like it'll be easier than I thought it was. I just got a zero sign, and that probably means I have to sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.